Hello everyone and welcome to our next episode. Today our topic is invasion of Ukraine and the relationship between geopolitics and Russian identity. It's great pleasure and honor to welcome Professor Tom Kazir. He's a chair in global politics of Europe at the University of Groningen. Before, he was a reader in international relations at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies. He led the school as academic director from 2014 to 2017 and was director of the Global Europe Center. He also held a Jean Monnet chair. Tom's research focused mainly on Russian foreign policy, European Union-Russian relations, and the European Union relations with Eastern neighbors. Tom is also recently joined our department. Tom, welcome, and it is a truly honor to having you today and looking forward to our discussion. Today we will discuss, broadly speaking, the invasion of Ukraine and the relationship between geopolitics and Russian identity, but more specifically, we will discuss also your timely and recent article. So the title of the article is No Great Russia Without Greater Russia, the Kremlin's thinking behind the invasion of Ukraine, which is published at the Canadian Journal of European and Russian Studies. And I really enjoyed reading that paper as well. And my first question related to this paper and broadly, because the paper argues that to understand the invasion of Ukraine, we need to have a better insight into the Kremlin's particular worldview and especially its identity, and not to stick to the only security and geopolitics. So how does the concept of geopolitics identity nexus, as presented in the text, shape Russia's pursuit of great power status and its decision to engage in territorial expansion, particularly in the context of the war against Ukraine?
Many thanks for having me. I think with the invasion of Ukraine, we've seen two things coming together, and this is exactly what this concept of geopolitics identity nexus tries to explain. So on one hand, we have this ambition of Russia, which is, you could say, an age-old ambition to be recognized as a great power. Yeah, that has always been there, but the ways in which Russia has tried to achieve that has changed over time. Mm-hmm. What we've seen happening now is that this came together with the idea that Russia could only reach this recognition as a great power through territorial expansion. Hence the title of the article, that Russia can only be greater Russia, great power Russia, if it also becomes territorially bigger, greater Russia in terms of its territory. And that's exactly where I think we see geopolitics and identity coming together and turning into a sort of worldview, a sort of prism that the Kremlin is using and through which it understands the world. Yeah, mm-hmm. And of course, this ambition of Russia to be recognized as a great power has always been there. Yeah, it's very often described as a historical factor in Russian thinking, very often with a reference to the Russian term of Derzhavnost. The idea of great powerness, mm-hmm. which is more than just the ambition to be a great power, it's about a sense of entitlement as well. The fact that Russia can only think of itself as a great power. There's no other way of conceiving itself. And you could argue that ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, the main objective in Russian foreign policy has been this recognition as a great power. Russia wanted to be seen as a great power again after the collapse of the Soviet Union. What has changed over time is the way in which Russia has tried to achieve that. So if you go back to the 1990s, and allow me to simplify a bit here, but if you go back to the 1990s, you can actually see that Russia tries to be recognized as a great power by being part of the international community of states, which in the 1990s is very clearly still a Western community of states. Yeah. So it wants to be one of them. Or as the Russian foreign minister back in those days said, Russia wants to be recognized as a normal great power, no longer the old communist enemy, but a normal great power among Western powers.
Yeah.
But then we see that Russia's ambition to be recognized as a great power is suffering more and more from frustration as time moves on, that Russia feels that the West is an obstacle to Russia becoming a great power. And this will slowly push Russia in the direction of a foreign policy that is much more based on an anti-Western rhetoric
aggressive.
That becomes increasingly first assertive and then indeed aggressive after some time. And you could say then with 2014, the annexation of Crimea, the start of the war in the Donbas, but then certainly with this massive military invasion of February 2022, Russia has reached its new stage where it's willing to use massive military force in order to reach its ambition of being a great power with a bigger territory.
To show actually that what it say and what it means. But recognized by only the Western powers, or by other powers as well, the powers, for example, in Asia, in Latin America, or do you think it is only the recognition is missing from the Western powers, especially from the United States and the European Union?
Well, it's interesting that Russia has gone through what they call this pivot to Asia. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Already before the Ukraine crisis of 2014, it announced that basically the West was sort of the old continent, and now the future was in the Asia-Pacific, and therefore cooperation with Asian countries and with China in particular was much more important. Hence also this strategic partnership it concluded with China right before the start of the war in Ukraine. At the same time, we see that Russia always has the tendency to use the West or Europe as its point of reference, mm-hmm. be it in a positive or a negative way. And that hasn't changed. So despite this announced pivot to Asia, there is still the idea that the real recognition has to come from the West somehow, and that Russia has to position itself, and that's again an element of identity, mm-hmm. it has to position itself vis-a-vis the West, yeah? Whether it wants to be one of them, or whether it does exactly the opposite and goes against the West and Western hegemony.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point, because when it comes to China-Russia relations, this recognition is not kind of necessary, or maybe it is already recognized by China as a part of the great power or part of the powers. Because now when we look at it, because we can also see there is this identity politics between, or the competition between China and Russia as well. China and the United States as well, because US doesn't want other great powers to emerge and to be recognized as a great power, so try to diminish that status. So I think maybe here we see Russia wants to be recognized as a great power by the United States, not necessarily maybe by the European Union. What do you think on that? That it's not about the Europe, but it's more about the US Russia competition.
Yeah, US comes first, and the way that Russia usually presents the European Union is as a puppet of America, yeah, without any autonomy, entirely controlled by Washington. When it comes to China, we have an interesting but very complex relationship. It's sort of logical in this sort of context where everything is about competition with the United States, that Russia sees China as a logical partner to work with. And that explains why they got closer to China. At the same time, this is not an alliance, and I think it has often been misrepresented, because this is a very complex relationship and a very delicate balance. Yeah, some authors have argued that Russia-China relations have worked on the basis of a very precarious balance in which China recognizes the military primacy of Russia, while the other way around, Russia recognizes the economic primacy of China. But of course, mm-hmm. this is changing. This has been changing for many years already. But it's changing even more as a result of this war, because Russia has made itself even more dependent on China than it was before. In that sense, it makes China even stronger. While China has played a very ambivalent role, has been quite careful, but I remember, for example, the spokesperson of the foreign ministry in the first days after the start of the war in Ukraine saying that a strategic partnership with Russia did not mean an alliance. Mm-hmm. There is certainly no willingness on the Chinese side to support Russia in whatever it does. Mm-hmm. And we may also remember Xi Jinping speaking out quite clearly against the threats that Putin made at some point about the use of nuclear weapons, whereby they send a clear message to Moscow that even threatening with the use of nuclear weapons was simply unacceptable.
It's not acceptable, yeah. Yeah. And I would like to move to the next question in the article, which is very good point, that it argues that Russia now sees the territorial expansion as essential for achieving great power status, represent a significant setback. What factors or events do you believe contributed to this shift in Russia's narrative regarding its borders and great power status? And how does this altered argument impact Russia's relation with neighboring countries and its broader geopolitical standing?
Yeah, it's a very important aspect, because I think if we want to understand what has happened, we need to make a distinction between more structural factors that explain the invasion and the massive use of military force against Ukraine. But we also need to understand the process factor. Mm-hmm. If you speak about structural factors, it has to do with this geopolitics identity nexus, for example. But it also has to do with the imperial mindset that is still very prevalent in Russia. The incapacity to think of Russia as not being an empire. The sort of idea that Putin expressed already very clearly in an article back in 2021, that Russia is bigger than the actual territory of the Russian Federation, and that Ukraine is basically Russian land. Yeah, and also just recently he referred to Odessa as a Russian city, for example, or a year ago he compared himself to Peter the Great, who, according to him, just took back what was Russian. Yeah, it's this sort of imperial mindset that Russia has never come to terms with. That's a structural factor. But we also need to explain why this has become prevalent and has become a sort of a driving factor of Russian foreign policy today. Why did the invasion of Ukraine not happen earlier? Why not in the early 90s, for example? Or why not in 2014, when we had the annexation of Crimea and the start of the war in the Donbas? Why did Russia not push through at a time when the Ukrainian army, for example, was much weaker and Ukraine had not the same sort of capacity to defend itself? And I think that's probably one of the questions that needs to be answered most urgently. And I see myself different elements of this, different process factors that may help to explain what has happened there. One of them has to do with the fact that what happened in 2014, the Ukraine crisis, was, against this imperial mindset, something that was experienced in Russia very much as a sort of existential crisis. It was a security crisis for the West, but for Russia, it went much beyond that. Yeah, it was seen as losing part of itself, precisely because of this imperial approach. I remember Solzhenitsyn, the novelist, for example, in the 1990s, writing about the collapse of the Soviet Union as a process that was not one of decolonization, but one of amputation, which is quite telling for this imperial mindset. It was as if Russia lost part of itself, rather than lost some of its colonies. And that has, of course, to do with the complexity of this empire that grew gradually over time, stepwise absorbing new territories without clear distinction between the fatherland, if you want, and the colonies, without clear distinction between center and periphery. Yeah. So there was this feeling in 2014 that there was an existential crisis by losing Ukraine to the West in the Kremlin's perception. That sort of radicalized the approaches to the Kremlin. At the same time, there was this idea that Russia would continue to try destabilizing Ukraine. And the Minsk agreement would serve that purpose. If it would get some autonomy for the Donbas region, it would allow Russia to keep a foot in the door. It would allow to make Ukraine into a liability for the West rather than a useful partner. But all of these policies didn't really function very well in practice. So we saw that the Kremlin tried out all sorts of things to destabilize Ukraine. There were intelligence operations, there were economic sanctions, there was the
energy crisis, all of it.
Precisely, energy prices were used very much in a strategic way. There was a policy of distributing passports in the Donbas region, and so on and so on. There was the blockade of the Kerch Strait, but none of these worked very well. So all of this didn't have the results that they were hoping for. And these may have led, but we have no ultimate evidence of that. We will only know when the archives would open one day. This may have led some people in the Kremlin to think that a military solution, which was probably imagined as a quick military victory, would be the best way to tackle this and to go about this.
Like Georgia happened in 2008, which was very quick, and they miscalculated maybe Ukraine with Georgia.
Yeah, like Georgia, but Georgia is quite a different case in the sense that it has a different, much more complex history going back to the early 90s, to the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union. Also the fact that some initiatives were taken by the Georgian president back then, Saakashvili, and Russia reacted to that and overreacted and flexed its muscles. So it has a sort of different history, I think. And in that sense, I think Russia was not there in 2008 where it is it was in 2022 when it started the large-scale invasion in Ukraine.
Yeah, and it's very good to talk about maybe a little bit further about this Russian identity of feeling I'm a colonial power and you colonies actually belong to me. I just let you live kind of independent within my borders. You shouldn't cross the border I draw for you. And sometimes as an academic, sometimes as a former Soviet Union citizen coming from Azerbaijan, when I read the Western newspapers, articles, I see this, for me personally, annoying term, Russian backyard. And don't you think these kind of phrases in academia, in the newspapers, because these newspapers, Western newspapers, are also read by the Russian elite and the society, and that we actually emphasize and strengthen this colonial perception of Russia over the former Soviet countries. Because the, if we use this, then actually this is in line with what Russia in reality think. If you continue, or the certain people or certain academics continue to call it Russian backyard, this actually is kind of emphasize what Russia believes, and rather than we are not challenging, I feel like, this in academia and newspapers. What is your maybe personal opinion on this using a backyard thing?
Absolutely. We've sort of come to see many countries that were part of the Soviet Union from a Russian perspective. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Precisely because when we were studying the Soviet Union, we were not necessarily making much of a distinction between all the different republics
exactly,
the complexity. We didn't see the complexity of the Soviet Union. And we have similar discussions now about concepts like post-Soviet space. Yeah? Mm-hmm. If they express the idea that there is some sort of commonality between all mm-hmm. these states,
yeah.
then it's a term we should indeed give up. I think in that sense, the war against Ukraine came as a sort of wake-up call for many researchers as well. It was a time for reflection and introspection for many researchers. And one of the things that was most striking, I think, and one of the things that, that many conference organizers have been struggling with, is that actually when they wanted to invite keynote speakers to talk about Ukraine, very often they had difficulties to find the right people because they mm-hmm. came to the conclusion that so few people had studied Ukraine in its own right,
yeah.
not through the prism of Russia or not through the prism of security tensions
exactly.
between Russia and the West. This was really lacking, and this is a conclusion that researchers should definitely draw. And in particular, in the field of international relations, yeah, maybe more than in the field of area studies, where we have the tendency to look at this sort of developments very much from certain theoretical perspectives. And mm-hmm. this happens from all theoretical perspectives. Yeah, there's very often the tendency, the inclination to explain what has happened from a simple theoretical perspective through a simple prism, whereby we indeed see Russia as the great power acting in its so-called backyard, as a country that has certain rights there, as Medvedev called it when he was president of Russia, that has privileged interests in that particular area. And I think in that sense, we also have to take a step as researchers to get rid of this sort of dominant approach and to try to understand things from a different perspective and to study different former Soviet states in their own right.
Yeah, exactly. Because as a person also in the field, I sometimes feel like we need to indeed look at this complexity and study all the former Soviet countries and approach them individually. Once I was in a conference, I never forget this, and a scholar approached me from one of the Western universities, and the person started to speak Russian to me. And I said, but I'm not from Russia. And she said, but you are from Azerbaijan. I said, yeah, so what is the value here? Yeah, what do you want to say? But I speak your language. I said, but that Russian is not my language. My language is Azerbaijani. And that person was calling herself expert on Azerbaijan. And I'm really surprised. Yes. I said, well, look, you studied and then traveled Armenia, traveled Georgia, and only speaking Russia. I said, look, here you emphasize a colonial history over us, over the people. Because, of course, because of the historical background, because of school education, maybe to some extent, the Russian language, similar to the English language, was part of it. But doesn't mean that someone can approach and then use just single language for whole Soviet Union countries and then say that, oh, I speak the Soviet Union language. You know, like, I think this approach indeed should be changed. Or hopefully after the Ukrainian war or during the process, I see that already the change is started. Well, here I would like to move also maybe the final question regarding the future prospectus, because I'm wondering, how do you foresee the nexus shaping the Russian foreign policy beyond the current conflict with Ukraine? And what are the potential long-term implications of this intertwined relationship between geopolitics and identity of Russia standing in the global arena?
I don't want to sound too gloomy, but I don't see much reason for optimism in the sense that I think what's happening in foreign policy, in Russian foreign policy, is a one-way street. I think that's the tragedy with this radicalization of the policy, with this use of massive military force, which is extremely significant, yeah, because we are facing now the biggest interstate war in Europe ever since the Second World War. But we're also seeing the final collapse of the post-Cold War security order, but also of some very fundamental principles of international law, both at a global level within the UN and at the European level. through the fact that Russia has broken one of the biggest taboos, that is that you don't use military force to expand your territory, yeah, because we know what this has led to in European history. But this means that in the entire post-Cold War security order is gone. Yeah, there is not even any room for negotiations. All of this, all of the disarmament treaties, for different reasons, over a longer period of time, have already collapsed. So there is basically no buffer there whatsoever in terms of sort of controlling, containing risky security situations. So I think there we have an enormous challenge that we are facing. But since the Russian foreign policy is driven so much by this identity thinking as well, by this imperial thinking as well, I don't see any way back. Yeah, we cannot imagine that all of a sudden the Putin regime will make important concessions, yeah, because it will be seen per definition as losing face. This also goes hand in hand with the same one-way street we have seen when it comes to domestic repression. Yeah, we've seen it has been a gradual process, but since 2012, very clearly a gradual process of increasing repression in Russia, which now has gone to the extent that the chair of Memorial, the human rights organization, which is now banned in Russia, has said that we have more cases in court for political crimes than we had during the Brezhnev days. Yeah, so this is how far the repression in Russia is going. Continue. And also that is a one-way street. There's also no way back there. So this means that two factors will determine the future of Russian foreign policy. The outcome of this war, which is still very uncertain. We have a sort of stalemate, but things may happen. Things may change in any direction. So it's too early to say. The other thing is what will happen to the Putin regime. And it's impossible to predict, and I'm certainly not going to predict anything on that. The only thing we know is that since we've gone through this sort of spectacular one or two days of Prigozhin mutiny of the Wagner group in Russia, that the unthinkable has become thinkable. And that this may have set into motion a couple of forces within the regime that may one day lead to the collapse of the regime. Again, this is not a prediction. I think it's impossible to predict these sort of things. But it's not entirely unthinkable. But I also think it's the only way out of this situation, in the sense that it's unimaginable under the current circumstances with the Putin regime that we would get the West and Russia and other forces in this world, like China, around the table to negotiate a new global security order. That's simply unthinkable. So it will be an important condition for any progress. And since we are uncertain whether it will happen, that is what makes me not very, very optimistic. We have a sort of stalemate in the war right now, and at the same time, there are no strong signs that the regime will collapse very soon. I think the longer term could be a different matter, but we will have to see.
Yeah, here is a very good point, the Russian regime, because that one I read a lot, and the newspapers and experts also mention, and they associate the war, of course, with the Putin and his regime. But the regime itself, I think it's very complex, and it has a number of regimes, sub-regimes inside. And I believe in the West, they positively assume that if this regime change, then the new regime will maybe much positive, optimist, or collaborative. But it could also go other way around. The regime could produce even hardliner than Putin, or the aggressor than Putin. That would actually lead to even further escalation with other, maybe Baltics, and even with Finland or other countries. I'm wondering, what would you maybe reflect on this regime? How dependent we are on this regime? Maybe I don't want to hear blame and make a statement on the maybe Russian society as general, but personally, individually, the Russians I read on Telegram or the Twitter, I don't see them anti-Putin or something. Maybe I am following more the ones that, but so far, even the liberal values, liberal scholars in Russia, the liberal experts that were, you know, like critics of Putin, and during the war, they changed 100 degree, and then they started to be more proactively supporting this. So I'm wondering whether it is really related to only regime or the society in total.
Yeah, which is a very important question, and one that is, from a research perspective, not so easy to answer. It's absolutely true. The liberals have been entirely sidelined. They still played an important role in the early years of Putin as president, for example. But it's also true that we have many more radical people than just Putin. And some authors have even argued that, that Putin largely co-opted nationalist thinking from society rather than the other way around. And it only, yeah, you only need to take a look at social media or at certain Russian talk shows on Russian state TV to understand there are many more radical thinkers. Yeah? So the end of Putin does not, per definition, mean a sort of better pro-Western regime or something. We're very far, far from that. Of course, the question will be if the regime collapses, under which circumstances will it happen? And a possible scenario would be that Russia will be facing economic difficulties. They have so far survived the sanctions quite well, but they're mainly surviving on the basis of a war economy. And this war economy may take its toll in the longer term, maybe not now, but within a couple of years, because a lot of money goes to defense, and that will have an impact on living standards probably in the longer term. And then the question will become whether this will affect what some have referred to as the social contract between Russian citizens and the government. Of course, it will. If we want a regime that that can sit again around the negotiation table, it will also take a different mindset, and it will have to imply that some Russian citizens understand that they have to come to terms with their own imperial past, and they have to look at their neighboring states in different ways. And part of the Russian citizens are certainly doing that. It's not necessarily the dominant tendency. And it is, as I said, very hard from a research perspective to get a good idea of what people really think, because there are, in the current context, basically no reliable surveys that we can rely upon.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Tom, thanks a lot for this fruitful discussion. It was really great to having you our podcast of the, let's say, the last podcast of this year. And one more time, welcome to our department, and looking forward to future collaborations and future works together.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners. And I wish everyone a happy Christmas and a happy new year. And hopefully 2024 will bring us peace, prosperity, and more stability. Stay safe, stay healthy.